Hi, I'm Jed Bodwin, and you're listening to Into Music from the KMUW Studios, part of the NPR Podcast Network. My guest on this episode is Mickey Brenny. She's back with the Mickey Brenny Trio, a band that releases its debut album, Tripla, on April 4th via Bella Union. She's also an author and was a member of the band Lush, in which she was co-guitarist and vocalist. We talked about a wide range of topics on this episode, including her approach to lyric writing and her reflections on the era in which Lush came up. That's all part of a conversation with Mickey Brenny on Into Music, coming up now. It's great to be speaking to you about this record, and this is interesting to me because this is a new beginning. So, what's this like? I mean, you have so much history as a musician and songwriter and everything, but now it's like blank slate in a way.
I mean, I don't know if it ever is a blank slate, if I'm honest, and not least because every band I've done has kind of come out of the previous one. You know, projects kind of overlap, and then I'm not one of life's planners. So opportunities arise and then you get kind of pulled along in whatever slipstream. So, you know, the kind of Lush thing, the Lush reunion specifically, the breakup of that led to Piroshka. Then I got offered to do that, the book, the memoir, which was kind of around lockdown. So it sort of made sense to sort of, all right, I'll do that then. And then in the wake of the book, because I didn't know this, but there's all these book events, you know, all these kind of literary festivals and all sorts of places have these book chats. So they invite you along, and because you're a musician, they want you to play a couple of songs. So really, it was just me, Moose and Ollie just playing like four Lush songs or something, you know, just to kind of give a bit of a extra to the book event. And then it was out of that that kind of the Mickey Brenny Trio happened, because we started getting offered gigs. And, you know, on the back of those little performances, oh, you should play a gig. Do you want to support this person? Do you want to do that? And then I thought, well, I don't want to just play a load of Lush songs. I don't want to be a covers band, basically. So then we just thought, all right, well, let's just crack on with writing stuff. And that means we can play. Because ultimately, I just want it to play. So Piroshka was great in that we wrote these albums and I really enjoyed that. But I realized that the sort of without the support and the infrastructure of, you know, record labels that have lots of money, it's, you know, what happens is you kind of record the record and you have to do it as cheaply as possible, and then you put it out and it's over, like in weeks, that's it, right? It's all over. And you play a handful of shows and then that's it. So with this band, we were like, well, let's just play. I like playing shows, so we'll just play. We haven't got anything to promote. We haven't got any album. We haven't got anything, but we just enjoy playing. So for about a year and a half, we're just playing those songs and writing stuff as we went along. So this album, I mean, the oldest song on it is probably about 2 years old, because we just wanted to play shows.
That doesn't happen very often, right? I mean, because, you know, kind of as you were saying, you know, somebody like you put together a band, there'd probably be label interest. And then, so this is a way for you to kind of hone the material, maybe find an audience, just have fun, essentially.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, there's also a bit of a last chance saloon about it. You know, I'm 57, but Moose is like 62. Ollie's, I'm not sure how old Ollie is, actually, somewhere between the two, I think. But, you know, it's all a bit, you know, twilight years. And so it's not like I'm thinking, oh, you know, let's launch a new band because we've got a real shot at like global success. We haven't, right? It's never going to happen. So you kind of have to do it for, I mean, they probably end up being quite pure reasons, but it is just the enjoyment of actually doing it and being able to play shows and being able to, I don't know, just actually enjoy it rather than aim for something that is always out of reach, you know, with some strategy that leads towards this sort of campaign and global success. Not going to happen. So just, it's very day to day. It's very kind of like, oh, it'll be, we'd quite like to go to Europe. Can you get us like four gigs in Europe so we can like go to France and have a nice time? It's a bit like that, really.
When you, for instance, when Lush started, was there a sense of like, we really want this to be as big as it is? Or is it, was it like this where it was like, oh, we're just gonna play at clubs, play for friends, see what happens?
I mean, I think when we were probably 19, 20 or something when we were sort of starting Lush. And I think at that age, I would say, there's always something in the back of your mind that thinks, wouldn't it be great if, but you don't realistically think that's going to happen, especially when you're driving around in a knackered kind of, ex-British Telecom van and I don't know, playing in tiny little venues and doing it all yourself. It's fun and it's exciting and it was very much at the time part of a kind of, music scene. There were just gigs and venues and club nights and all sorts of stuff. It was very vibrant. So it was very easy to fall into. I think when we signed to 4AD, it suddenly felt like, oh, wow, okay, that's a bit of a step up. And then very quickly, all that kind of going to America and going to Japan, and suddenly it's sort of all happening to you. And you haven't really got time to collect your thoughts and think about where it's going. And really, then it becomes part of what a record company does and a manager, and they're the ones telling you of the potential for this and the potential for that. I mean, largely, I just seem to remember being slightly dazzled by that part of it. And, you kind of want to believe all these amazing things that people are telling you is going to happen. But then that quickly turns into like, okay, so that was just bollocks, right? Okay. So that was just, hot air. Every band gets told that just to make them go on tour and keep on the treadmill. So I think in some ways, the kind of the Mickey Brenny Trio thing feels like the experience of right at the start of Lush, because the expectations are kind of wide open, or you don't really take them seriously. One or two people may say to you like, oh, I can, imagine you, playing that song in a stadium, and you look at them like they're nuts and go, yeah, right. There's a tiny bit in the back of your heart and mind that thinks that would be nice, but you don't really believe it. And so you do it for the pure enjoyment, I think. It's genuinely exciting when I think about those early days of Lush. Everything seems like a kind of, oh, wow, it's a real gasp moment and everything feels exciting. And it feels a bit like that now, I mean, not in the sort of dewy-eyed way, but I can get very excited about playing, a gig to 120 people in Wales. Because I know I've got a couple of mates coming and it'll be a really great night out.
Is there a point in there where you're experiencing kind of a duality of like, it's like, wow, well, this is what we started out doing. We're having success doing something we love, but now we're beholden to all these other interests. And I'm not even sure if this is enjoyable anymore on some level.
I mean, I think we were very lucky to be on 4AD, and certainly up to a point, I mean, even 4AD and that whole independent world changed a lot. But, certainly when we originally signed to them, there wasn't, there was an expectation to want the records to do well, obviously, but that wasn't the be all and end all. Right? Because 4AD were independent. I mean, if you look back at, some of their biggest bands like Pixies and Cocteau Twins or whatever, those bands did not get in the top 10, right? Certainly not with singles, because it wasn't that kind of label. That was not the aim. Sometime around the kind of mid-90s, the whole industry became all about that. And I think that's when that became really difficult, because without that success, you were every record you made was just clinging on the thread of success, because if you didn't get it, you would be dropped. And that's what was happening from that point onwards, and you'll notice all of those bands, Slow Dive, My Bloody Valentine, whoever, they all split up, Ride, whatever, because that kind of music doesn't work within that environment. It's not about producing top five hits. It's about albums. It's about, introspective music that you have to kind of, it's not instant hit. The chorus isn't in the first 5 seconds and all that kind of radio friendly, whatever narrative. And I think it was a real homogenization of music where there's just no room for that kind of music. And because all the infrastructure went, all those sort of fairly large independent labels, the whole idea of college radio and that supportive environment for that kind of music just evaporated. Well, then it's all gone. I mean, I think the only reason there's any kind of a resurgence in that kind of thing is possibly because of modern technology. It's very cheap to record at home. You know, you don't need a massive record advance to actually record an album now. You know, it can be done very cheaply. Because otherwise, I don't think any of these bands would have the money to go into a studio and have a producer and, you know, all the stuff that that requires. And, you know, and if you want to, you can just put it out on Bandcamp. You know, it doesn't require that kind of physical release or whatever. I mean, that also means you get absolutely no traction, but then you have to rely on pure luck to be discovered. But, you know, there are ways of still doing it. So I think, you know, while I understand that thing of like bands being caught in this sort of whirlwind where they're suddenly questioning why they're doing this at all because it's kind of machine that's sort of churning you through it, I can see why there was, you know, a lot of that was a necessary part of it. You know, part of music is playing live. And if you're going to play live everywhere, that is time consuming and it's a huge thing to organize. So I understand that complaint of, oh my God, we were on tour for like 9 months or whatever. But it kind of requires that if you are going to play to loads of people. And, you know, I would never have wanted to be in a band that could do the same thing in only, you know, half the time because they're only playing in stadiums of 10,000 people. That to me is not a gig, right? It's a kind of gig, but it's not really the kind of thing that I enjoyed or particularly want to do or particularly go to even, right?
This is wonderful to me with the trio, because I think this is this example of I think about this a lot, because I think we there's you know, when I was younger, I was like, okay, well, surely there's like a line for creativity, right? Like these stories and poems and things that I have in my head, they're gonna go away someday, right? And it's amazing because it just keeps going, right? No matter what, those impulses are there, and that urge to create remains.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think it's a very human thing, creativity. You know, it's just finding the channel with which you do it. You know, I didn't do music for 20 years, but I was cooking constantly. You know, that was my outlet for quite a long time. And I think the thing about, I suppose the thing about music and, like you say, writing, and I mean, you know, all of these, they are quite different in experience. And I do think that having written a memoir and people are like, it's very flattering when people say, oh, you're going to write another book or whatever. And I'm like, it's really solitary. It's hard work being on my own in my own head for that amount of time working on one thing. Oh my God, it was great. Like the achievement was great, but the process was quite torturous. Whereas I think with music, specifically with a band, right, there's so much kind of bouncing off each other and collaboration. And, you know, it's got an inbuilt support structure where you come up with a bit of a new song or you add to someone else's, and people are immediately like, oh, I really love that. And then they run with it. And there's a kind of whole energy that's kind of to do with collaboration that I find a lot easier. You know, it's a lot more fun. And the fact that you can then go out and play shows, even before you've written the album, you could just have a couple of new songs. And the reward of even just playing those two new songs and having an audience react to it, you know, it just kind of feeds the energy the whole time without you having to just commit to it on your own until it is this completely finished product. And then you kind of birth it into the world. You know, the whole process can be rewarding and back and forth and fun, you know. So I think in that respect, making music suits me a lot more. And that sort of energy pushes you into creativity. And you know, at the end of the day, with something like music or writing or whatever, especially I mean, I tend to write lyrics that are quite personal. You know, I know it's such a cliche to say, hey, I write for myself, but there's an element of that, you know, you are entertaining yourself quite literally. And my lyrics are personal, and I do have a sort of, there's some sort of emotional outpouring in them. Well, that changes as you get older. What you expressed when you were 23 is not going to be the same thing that you feel at 57, you know. So there's always new material there. There's always new terrible things that have happened to you that you can write about.
Yeah, I mean, that's so I'm 52. And, you know, I would say in the, maybe the last 7 years or something, I've come into so many of these realizations about emotions. Like, you know, we talk about like angry young people. And I think like at this point in my life, there's much more to be angry about in the world. And so it's,
sure.
Yeah. And so it's like one of those things where it's like, oh, that wasn't an emotion or that wasn't a spectrum of emotions I was expecting to experience right now.
Yeah. I mean, I think, and there's also the kind of changing perspective of maturity. I mean, I actually do think when I was young, I could, you know, I think that was the time of, you know, I kind of nearly all of my youth was under Thatcher, or my conscious youth, you know what I mean? She came in 79 when I was like 12, and then the Tories were in for like until I was 30 something, do you know what I mean? So my entire 20s, and it was there's sort of resonances with this whole Trump era and the division of classes, and you know, the sort of loss of faith in kind of institutions. Like I can really feel the echoes of that from when I was younger. And there was a lot of anger around that then, and it was very politicized time. But I do think I can see the difference in my attitude towards it. You know, there's a much more ideological, we just have to beat these people. We just have to crush them and beat them, and then the world will be okay. Well, we did that and the world wasn't okay, and it isn't again. And so the perspective on that, it, for me, is quite different, right? I get this sort of rising tides of quite frightening politics, but you know, you and I both grew up in our childhood in the kind of shadow of the Second World War, which was the sort of greatest atrocity. So I think there was always a feeling, well, it's bad, but it's not that bad, right? And now I think because it's been such a long time since that war, you almost worry that people have forgot about how bad it can get, right? You know, because I do think our generation was very much, you know, it wasn't beaten into us, but it was impossible to avoid, right? You know, whether it was clearly the Holocaust, but even the kind of disruption that happened to people's lives in, you know, places that, you know, were not even bombed, you know, places like America. I mean, you know, yes, Pearl Harbor, but do you know what I mean? But the hardships and the kind of, you know, the rationing and the lack of, like, you know, opportunity, blah, 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 you know what I mean? And the immigration and the refugees and the sweep of history across the globe, all of that kind of had a huge effect, I think, on our generation, because our parents may have been born around that time, but it was almost, you know, wagged as a finger against us if we were too rebellious, that, oh, you have no idea what hardship is because you didn't live through the Second World War. And you bought that. You thought, yeah, you're right. I can't argue with that at all, right? We don't really have that now. It's such a long time ago that, to me, that's some of the worry, that there's people who seem very kind of easy with the idea of some sort of global warfare, as though it's going to have some sort of cleansing effect, you know, when actually, you know, you, me, our parents can tell you the last thing on earth you want to go through is a war. If you think things are bad now, oh my God, right? There are first-hand accounts. We were educated in this. And I just suspect that a lot of people now aren't. It's romanticized. They think that they're tough enough to get through it. They're not. You know? And so I think that's what's quite interesting to me about this wave of politics, that there's a lot more bravado around thinking that you know, that they can handle it, and they won't at all. I certainly don't want to be around for that.
Well, the finger wagging element is interesting, because yes, you know, I had a, you know, my father grew up in poverty. So, you know, when I was growing up, you know, he'd say, oh, you're lucky you have two pairs of shoes. And, you know, when he was 17, he was already in the Navy and in a submarine in the South Pacific in the war. So I was going to college. I was very privileged. And I look at that now and I see young people today and where the world is headed, and I worry about them a little bit because of things like they might not be able to afford a house. Their education may be, you know, disrupted by AI or something. And so now I'm like, man, I really have kind of had an easy life.
I mean, I think every generation has its version of privileges. Or, you know, certainly in my knowledge, you know, in the Western kind of European tradition, right? And I think that You know, every generation before can go like, oh, you have no idea how hard it was. You know, you're so spoiled. You've got this, you've got that. Partly because of just technological medical progress means that on a kind of base level, there are things that, you know, we're not dying in childbirth in our, you know, proportionally that amount of numbers and or children even dying. Like, do you know what I mean? Infant mortality, blah, 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 all of these sort of general things that have improved. But outside of that, you know, I get it. You know, I do see that younger generation, the kind of the privileges that I see, which are quite material, right? I mean, the idea to me when I was growing up that you could ever have a place with an ensuite bathroom, that alone to me is ridiculous. And yes, you're saying two pairs of shoes. I mean, people, my son has like 15 pairs of trainers or something, you know what I mean? It's absolutely ludicrous. So there's all of that, but then, you know, yeah, the kind of stability, never mind even the owning a house, which I never particularly, I suppose I just didn't think about it because it just felt like something that might happen one day. It didn't feel like there was a pressure where you thought, well, you might never own a house. That just, this wasn't something you had to think about when you were in your young 20s or a student or whatever. But even the idea, you know, we would all sit there and take the piss out of whatever degrees we were doing, especially I did English literature, but you know, you would go like, oh, well, it's just rubbish, isn't it? It's not worth the paper it's written on. But in the back of your mind, you thought, no, this is worth something, right? And in Britain, it was also free and it was subsidized. You know, you got a grant, you got your rent subsidized. You know, there were all kinds of privileges that we completely took for granted. Now you've got people, or certainly my kids, you know, effectively spending about or getting into the debt of, to the tune of about £50,000 or more, probably, never knowing if that debt is going to be paid off, never knowing if it's actually going to be worth anything, right? If it's actually, or are they just going to be working, you know, is the best that they can hope for to be an Amazon manager or something, you know, in a warehouse? I mean, you know what I mean? It's that rocky and that unpredictable. Certainly not expecting to own a house, not until me and Moose pop our clogs anyway, you know. And so I think it's that weird, the thing maybe that I kind of think is so difficult for that generation is actually complete uncertainty. You know, I don't think we kind of knew that life was relatively crap. I don't think I had any illusions that, you know, I didn't have my head filled with that kind of, you can be anything. You could be a millionaire. We didn't really have that. Maybe you did in America. We certainly didn't. But you kind of felt that things would be all right. There was a safety net. You'd probably end up having a house. You know, it might not be a big one, but it will be something. The NHS will keep going. It will keep you safe while you're living. You know what I mean? If anything terrible happens, it was just these baseline kind of safety net things that you thought life will probably be okay. So you didn't really catastrophize about that stuff. Now it's all catastrophizing, right? It's all what ifs. Every sort of positive is like kind of poisoned with a potential negative, and the worry that you could be 40 years old, wanting to have children, not have a roof over your head, not have a job, not have any stability. NHS might be gone by then, no pension ahead of you, you know, all of that. So I'm getting quite anxious actually talking about it.
Well, so do you feel that then the creation of music is in some ways, without, you know, trying to be trite about it, but that in some ways that's also a blowback of it, that there's this, the creative act in and of itself is kind of a balm to all those upsets.
I mean, I think, what do I think? I don't know if it is. I mean, I feel very privileged because I've worked, you know, I've earned my money, I've got my house, I've got all that at a time when it was perfectly possible to do without having to earn an absolute fortune, you know. So for me to make music, which none of us makes any money out of, right? We can do that because we've got day jobs and we can, you know, it becomes, that's why we can't go on tour for 9 months because we all have jobs, right? Now, I'm assuming that that's the case for a lot of young people. I mean, I've known people who have got bar jobs or, you know, they kind of have 0 hours jobs so that they can go on tour, you know, so that, but that means that they have they're not good jobs, right? So they don't earn very much, but they're young and they want to kind of, have a crack at it. And so fair play to them, but it's a lot of work. And that's why you end up with a lot of people. I don't know how true this is. I don't know whether, it's just a bit of a tabloid headline, but that idea that there's a lot of, privileged people now in music because they can afford to, go on tour and do all these things because they've got, parental money or funding or whatever, so I don't, I don't really know if it's a bum. I mean, I do it because I actually just really enjoy it. I do think that if people don't just like music, people who go into it really do love it. I'm sure it's the same if you go into filmmaking, which I imagine is an incredibly complicated and expensive career as well. But it's worth it because you have a passion for it, and then that you would regret it if you never even had a go. But that's increasingly becoming a luxury. And I do despair at that because, again, I think when I was growing up, art, literature, music, sport, all of these things were like, very important in the kind of educational curriculum, just at primary school level, not on any privileged level. They were just absolutely normal part of school, and there was an acknowledgement that those sort of expressions of creativity are kind of quite basic human instincts. I've got this anecdote. I remember when a lot of my contemporaries were having like small children, and I can remember, when parents get a bit pretentious about their 3-year-old and they're like, oh yes, she's really into Guernica because I've got a poster and she loves Picasso and all that. And you think, okay, no, she loves color and she loves, there's sort of something very sort of instinctive about, small children respond to color and animation and music and expressions and acting and singing, and all of those things are just, they're primal and they're there in very small children. So when they're pursued into adulthood and refined and made more sophisticated and complex and all of that, they all spring from something incredibly human. And I think that the kind of, dismissal of the arts as something that is a waste of time and we should just be honing our children for like money making workplaces where it's like, okay, make them all do science. I get that, and computers and these sort of practical and sort of technological skills. Of course, those things are really important, but you have to accommodate the other side of that. It's incredibly important. And I mean, God, and most of the doctors and scientists I know who people who went on to pursue those things think they also think it's incredibly important. They have those pursuits. They have music or they go, I'm so glad that one of the A levels I did was English literature because it's like really you need that kind of rounded education. And I think, yeah, like I say, I think downplaying the importance of all of those things or just treating them as peripheral, I think is that's new to me. I've not seen that. Even like you say, in that hardened kind of, people who went through the Second World War or whatever, I mean, they all thought that things like music and art and theatre and all of those things were important. They didn't think it was rubbish, did they?
No. In fact, there's I can't remember the title of it now, but there's a book about how the U.S. government during World War II would drop paperbacks, in kits for soldiers. So when they came out, they were, they'd read Homer or they'd read Hemingway or whoever. And that's kind of fascinating that somebody had the foresight of these men need some sort of, I don't know, distraction or whatever. They need some sort of education as well to deal with what they're going through.
Yeah, that's a really good point, actually, because I wonder if that's part of the kind of, okay, I'm literally riffing here, but that kind of mental health explosion of like hugely problematic kind of people with anxieties and depressions and all kinds of things. And I do sometimes wonder whether, yeah, maybe there is a link there that there was, because it wasn't just giving some soldier a novel or whatever. They were quite deep, it's quite deep literature. It really makes you think about the world and it kind of impacts you emotionally. And even when I think of the kind of movies that were going on, throughout history, they've got real soul to them and there's sort of darkness and complexity and philosophy involved. If all you're getting is YouTube videos or like TikTok snippets or something. I mean, there's no depth to that. There's no place for your soul to kind of expand into. So yeah, maybe that's part of it.
Not really a question, but too, I remember going to college and there was a psychology professor who I had to drop a paper off at his office one night and he was listening to opera. And I thought, this is so fascinating. I'm like, he's like, oh, and he could, you give him pretty much any opera, I found out over time, and he could relay the story to you. And, he had interest in visual arts. And I was like, that is a way to be in life, in that you have a profession, but you also have a universe that allows you relief from that.
Yeah, God, that's a really good point. Because I can see how, I mean, I've never been an opera fan, but I can see how listening to that kind of music and classical music, it's quite meditative, isn't it? It does allow your thoughts to just ramble, but also get immersed in this and coloured by this whole world of what you're listening to. Again, rather than this sort of fast world delivery system of like what you want just given instantly packaged as a kind of morsel, there's space in that kind of music. And probably even in all of those like novels and cinema, that sort of long form that allows you to actually breathe in them, it's not just distraction, it's immersion, I think.
Well, I'll finish on this because I have a sense you and I could go for probably quite some time.
Sorry. Yeah, this is a really good chat. Forget the broadcast. Yeah.
But I wanted to just to kind of bring it back to the record. There is this element in the music that there is, I think, this really important thing that's sometimes absent, I think, in music, where there's a sense of like emotional counterpoint, because listening to the record, sometimes I get the sense that maybe the music feels uplifting, but there's a tinge of melancholy in the lyrics and things like that. That seems like that's something that's important to you compositionally, that it's got that depth and you can revisit it and find new things over time.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's always, I think lyrically, that's always been the mood, I think, of the lyrics that I write, even with a pop song like Lady Killers, right? I remember thinking I'm going to, I would love to be able to write just a really simply happy tune with a happy lyric. When people do it well, I think it's astonishing. It's just absolutely out of my capacity. And like I say, the nearest I sort of got was, right, Lady Killers, I'm just going to make this really sassy song and whatever. But there's still a kind of negative edge to it. There's still a kind of, darkness on the periphery of it. There's an anger to it, I suppose. And I think that lyrics are always something that have been a release for a lot of things that are on my mind. And there is a kind of, I'll get an idea down, but I need to, there's all these different facets that I want to try and shoehorn into the song to get the right sense of what I actually think. And it's the way I talk as well. I'm a terrible one, as you can tell, for rambling off into tangents, because there's all these different sort of ideas that are kind of popping that balance the whole thing. And that is very much how I think of lyrics, where, it might be a sad song. It might set out to be a sad song about a recollection or a memory of someone who's no longer there or something. But then there'll be happy bits to that and thoughts that I don't want to write a depressing song. I don't want to set out to write a depressing song. I probably am just trying to get what is in my head and all the things that spark my interest down into a lyric so that there's hints of it all over, which means it will just be quite layered, I suppose. I mean, I'm a terrible one for mishearing lyrics, and I often get asked, I get quoted my lyrics back and saying, oh, what does this line mean? And I actually think that's not actually what the line is, but your interpretation of it is probably more personal and better for you. So why don't you just stick with that? It doesn't have to be right. It's what you feel and what moves you, and that's absolutely fine, right? But I suppose because the music, I mean, specifically with this album, I think a lot of the music is quite up because we were writing to play it live. And I don't really want to go on a stage and bore everyone witless with some sort of 8-minute, slow tune. So yeah, we were kind of on the upbeat on the actual tunes, and then we can get all the moody stuff in on the lyrics.
yeah. I mean, because that's, just talking about the emotional part of it, that's part of it too. Like, even if you're grieving somebody, right, sometimes in the midst of that, you have that happy memory or something happens and you say, oh man, this would have been hilarious to them.
Well, and I think when you're grieving someone, or certainly when you're writing about that grief and they're quite central to that lyric, you don't want to only remember that person for that sadness, because the reason you miss them and the reason that it feels like such a loss is because they weren't always, you know, like, it wasn't always bad. It used to be fucking great, you know, and that's part of the, you know, that's the terrible kind of feeling of loss, is that that happy person and all the joy that they brought is no longer there. And yeah, I don't know. Multi-layered emotional responses to things. And also, you know, don't forget with lyrics, there's a tendency, you know, you can think, oh, you know, I want to write about this subject. And you, all the cliches come out, right? Because that is what we all feel. We all feel the cliches, whether it's illness or death or marriage or love or anything. There's just all cliches. And you're trying to get beyond that curtain of the general and the cliché to find something specific that you feel that you're putting out there that might be a nuance of something new, you know, that someone can latch onto that will be particularly personal to them in the forest of cliches.
You've been listening to a conversation with Mickey Bereny. Her new album with the Mickey Bereny Trio, Tripla, is out April 4th via Bella Union. You can learn more about the trio and Mickey's other endeavors, including trio dates in the EU and US, at mickeystuff.com. Our digital producers are Carly Cooper, Beth Golay, and Hugo Fan. Our theme music is composed and performed by Torn Anderson. You can send us questions and comments at info@kmuw.org and find all the latest programming notes on our website as well. Thanks again for listening. We will see you next time.
This is Tanya Mosley, co-host of Fresh Air. You'll see your favorite actors, directors, and comedians on late-night TV shows or YouTube. But what you get with Fresh Air is a deep dive. Spend some quality time with people like Billie Eilish, Questlove, Ariana Grande, Stephen Colbert, and so many more. We ask questions you won't hear asked anywhere else. Listen to the Fresh Air podcast from NPR and WHYY.